TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The Great War for Civilization. The Conquest of the Middle East. Robert Fisk has lived in and reported on the Middle East since 1976 and has seen or tracked down first-hand accounts of all the major events of the last quarter century. He says that every journalist in the Middle East needs to keep a history book in their pocket as a reminder of why we got to where we are and why the injustices inflicted by the West on the Middle East are engraved in people's minds and have a powerful influence on what happens next. Tragically, though, Fisk says, the relationship of America with the Middle East is the one taboo subject in the U.S. In the first half of this program, Fisk explained how surprised he is that the Muslim world has been so patient with their aggressors. And he ended by saying that the Americans must leave, will leave, can't leave. That's the equation that turns sand into blood. End of quote. Here is Robert Fisk with the second half of his talk as he contemplates American projection of power in Iraq.
Did we invade, we ask ourselves in our articles, Iraq for oil? Of course we did. Of course we did. The oil ministry and the Ministry of Interior were the only two ministries that were saved from burning and looters when the Americans entered Baghdad. And if, for example, the net export, the national export of Iraq was asparagus or cauliflower or grapes, I don't think the 82nd Airborne would be in Mosul, and I don't think the 3rd Infantry Division would be in Baghdad. But there's something else. Not so long ago, I was on Highway 8, the throat-cutting insurgency road south of Baghdad, investigating the murder of a poor Red Cross driver who had been killed in his vehicle, talking to an Iraqi family who I think had probably seen the gunman who did the killing. And the ground began to shake. Tremblement de terre, as the French say. And up the road, powering up the road, was the biggest military convoy I've ever seen in my life. Mile after mile after mile of it, 4.25 hours it took to pass. Abrams, M1, A1 tanks, Bradley fighting armored vehicles, Humvee after Humvee, hundreds of trucks with tens of thousands of line troops with their rifles pointing out of the side of the lorries, like porcupine quills, into the wilderness of occupation. Apache helicopters turning over the palm groves like some big rodents going backwards and forwards. Extraordinary experience to watch it. And I sat there with the family in the muck at the side of the road and watched this, and I thought, you know, 2,000 years ago, a little bit more to the west, in Syria or Lebanon, the ground would have shaken beneath the tramp of the feet of Roman legions. And I realized, I think, then more than ever, that a superpower has a visceral need to project military strength. We can go to Baghdad, so we will go to Baghdad. We can topple Saddam. We'll send our soldiers across Sumeria and all the lands of the caliphates and the land where civilization supposedly began. Let's go. I've argued and been angered by, for many, many months now, what I call hotel journalism. The reporter who goes to Baghdad stays in his hotel room, uses his mobile phone to call the Americans or the British in the green zone, the area of the former presidential palace of Saddam Hussein, or talks to the Iraqi government that's been democratically elected, etc., etc., and files his story, but does not tell his viewer or his listener or his reader that he doesn't leave his hotel. There's no health warning. You get the impression he's able to wander the streets, go out on a tour d'horizon, check out the stories when the Americans say 142 terrorists we killed in Tel Afar, no innocent people at all. That in some way he's been able to check it out, so it's all true. Comma, American officials say becomes the watchword. This phrase, American officials say, it's become part of our life of journalism now, part of the way we write. Let me give you an example of this. This is the Los Angeles Times of Wednesday. In a battle of wits, Iraq's insurgency mastermind stays a step ahead of the US. It's an excuse by the military as to how Zarqawi, if indeed he exists, and I have my doubts, how Zarqawi has managed to be one step ahead of the Americans. But look at the sourcing. I ask you not to laugh till the end of this bit. Here are the sources quoted. Page 1, column 1. US authorities say, US officials said. Column 2, officials said, US authorities say, US officials said. Turn to page A10, column 1. Several US officials, familiar, said. Those officials said. The officials confirmed. American officials said. Column 2, the US officials stressed. Column 3, US authorities believe, said one senior US intelligence official. US officials said, Jordanian officials said, column 4, several US officials said, the US officials said, column 5, American officials said, column 6, say US officials say, US officials say, one US counterterrorism official said. I think the Los Angeles Times should be called US officials say. It's much easier. It can be actually published in Washington. You don't need to worry about anything else. But coming back to this problem of journalism in Iraq, you see, it's in the interests of the Americans, the British, that we can't move around. They don't want us to go and count innocent dead bodies in bombed buildings in Tal Afar, even when film comes back from brave Iraqi cameramen showing that among the insurgents, and of course there are insurgents killed, are women and children and innocent civilian men as well. What do you do about hotel journalism? What kind of journalism can we do? I call it mouse journalism. Example, August, 2 suicide bombings in the Nahda bus station in Baghdad. Fisk goes out, bit of street reporting, drives to the area, 2 Iraqi friends with me, get to the scene, severed body parts, bus is on fire. I jump out of the car, take 2 pictures, one of a baby burning next to a bus. And I have 20 seconds interviewing an eyewitness before 40 or 50 Iraqis are banging on the roof of my car in fury and anger, and I jump in the car and race away. Mouse journalism, right? It's enough for 600 words, but I ask myself now, and it's the first time I've ever done this in the Middle East, can we carry on in Baghdad? I'm not sure. You can still find out little fragments of truth. One Monday last August, I went to the Central City mortuary. I go there very often to count bodies. I know the staff. They're kind to me. They give me lots of cups of tea. Good to have, because often the electricity has failed and it's very hot and there are flies all over the corpses, so I'm counting them. That Monday morning, by 9 o'clock, there were 9 dead bodies. By 12 o'clock, there were 26, including a young woman, hands tied behind her back, shot 3 times in the head, a baby shot in the face. There are death squads now in Baghdad, working for everybody, including, I suspect, the Iraqi government, but also the insurgents, the Shiites, the Sunnis, all kinds of groups. Then they let me use their computer and look up the total deaths by violence in Baghdad for July. These are the official figures, government figures, which we're told don't exist because it's too difficult to get hold of them. The British and American authorities have told the Iraqi authorities not to give these figures to journalists, not even to allow us into the mortuaries. Fortunately, the medical authorities and I know each other well. Fisk goes in the back gate. So I looked on the computer, and I found that the total deaths by violence, not heart attacks or strokes, deaths by violence of Iraqis in just Baghdad, in just July alone, was 1,100. The highest figure ever recorded at a medical centre. More than half the total figure of American dead since March, April of 2003, in just July, in just Baghdad. Now, add Mosul, Kirkuk, to some extent Erbil, Ramadi, Fallujah, Bakuba, Amara, Najaf, Kerbala, Basra, and all the other cities of Iraq, we must be talking of 3,000 or 4,000 a month. That's 36,000 or 48,000 a year. Which means that 100,000 figure, which was poo-pooed by Bush and Blair, may actually be quite conservative. These are the little fragments we can still do, but I ask myself, is it worth the risk? Each trip to the mortuary, 20 minutes only, because after 20 minutes, the guys with the mobile phones outside have had enough time to call in 3 armed men with a car to take away any foolish grey-haired foreigner who happens to be wandering around the mortuary. We all have our nightmares in life, and mine is sitting in front of a video camera with my hands tied, asking Mr. Blair to withdraw British troops from Iraq. We all have these nightmares. So did the Guardian correspondent, if you read his graphic report of being kidnapped a couple of weeks ago. So over and over again, you know, how do we carry on in these circumstances? But when you're an Iraqi, and Iraqis are very educated people, it looks a little different. An Iraqi asked me when I was last in Baghdad, "Mr. Robert, why is it the Americans are everywhere in our area?" And he listed the countries: Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan. These are American military forces, Air Force, Special Forces, infantry units. Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Turkey, Israel, Jordan, Egypt, Oman, Yemen, Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait, still part of Saudi Arabia. I mean, why are we here? Why are you there? It actually starts further north. Greenland, Iceland, Britain, Germany, Bosnia, Yugoslavia now, Italy, Greece, joining up with the Turkish bit. There is now an iron curtain from the ice cap to the borders of Somalia. Why? And why does it run through the Middle East? Why is it that the American military bases newly established in eastern Afghanistan, and it's Mariv, the Israeli paper that spotted this, follow exactly the route of the gas pipeline which the Americans want to build from the former Muslim states of the Soviet Union to Pakistan? What are we doing in the Middle East? You know, we want always to give the Arabs democracy. We want them desperately to have democracy. We push it at them, we threaten them with democracy. And I think they'd like some of that democracy. I think they'd like a couple of boxes of human rights off our Western supermarket shelves. I think they would. But I also think they want a different kind of freedom. I think they would like freedom from us. Always. Always. When we come to liberate the peoples of the Middle East, we seem to arrive, as we did in Lebanon, of course, in 1982, with our 155mm artillery and our Apache helicopters and our swords and our horses and our Humvees and our Abrams tanks. I think, you know, that the Muslim world would like a serious, moral, mature relationship with us. And I think we should have one with the Arab world. We can stay there. But why do we always take our armies there? You know, after the First World War, before we, the British and the French, chopped up and carved up the Middle East, there was a bright, shining light from the United States. The American diplomats of the Middle East, who were the consuls to the dying Ottoman Empire, and all the American NGOs, who of course were missionaries at that stage, all petitioned the State Department that there should be one modern, democratic Arab state stretching from the southern border of Turkey, the eastern border of Mesopotamia, Iraq, right across to the Atlantic coast of Morocco. This would be a state like any other European state planned for the forthcoming century. But of course, as we know, President Woodrow Wilson fell sick and died. America moved into isolationism. On the Hill, they weren't interested. They didn't fulfill the American mandate for Kurdistan, which might have solved the Kurdish problem, or Armenia. Armenia was to be reconstituted inside Turkey, not the rump state with Yerevan as its capital, which has survived to this day. And so the Americans declined to actually even join the League of Nations. It was very remarkable. One of the good things for my paper, ask my foreign editor who works out our budget, is that because I, every 3.5 weeks on average, come and give lectures in the United States, I'm often around Harvard or New York when the UN is holding important meetings. My foreign editor loves this. He doesn't pay the airfare, he just gets the copy, you see. And on September 12th, 2002, I was in the UN General Assembly to listen to President George W. Bush threatening the United Nations. If it didn't abide by its duties, it would be as irrelevant as the League of Nations, he said. Ignoring the fact, if he knew it, that the League of Nations failed because the superpowers in the League of Nations refused to abide by its resolutions. In particular, France and Belgium, which occupied the Saarland of Germany to get its reparations under the Treaty of Versailles. Bush was apparently unaware that one of the reasons why the League of Nations also failed is that America refused to join it. The United Nations is a creation of Truman and the ideas of Roosevelt. In any event, here in the United Nations, one is forced to ask a question which is pivotal to comprehending, I suspect, the Middle East. Can we switch history off? Can we turn to the Middle East as we can to ourselves and say, let's start again? We can do it. We in the West can do it. The end of the Second World War, the death of Hitler, the death of Mussolini, the destruction of the Japanese Empire. The founding of the United Nations, the start of what was to become the European Union, the end of the Cold War. I suppose somewhere in there 9/11 will come in the future, I'm not sure. But we can close the doors on history and start again. And we think we can tell the Arabs and the Israelis to do the same thing, but we can't. Mohammed Abu Radina lives in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camp, scarcely 2 miles from my home in Beirut. And when he gets up in the morning, he rises in muck and filth and dirt amid taps that spew out brown water. And he is there as a direct result of the Balfour Declaration of 1917, when we, the British, gave our support to a Jewish homeland in Palestine on condition that the native Arab inhabitants didn't have their rights in any way taken away. Of course, we betrayed both the Jews and the Arabs. The Jews had every right to believe that we meant all of Palestine, not the bit on the left next to the sea. And the Arabs had every right to believe that they would stay in their homes. We didn't, in the Balfour Declaration, say they'd have to leave. But for Mohammed Abu Radina, our betrayal of what Balfour said is the specific reason why he gets up in the morning in the dirt and muck of the Sabra and Shatila camp. For him, Balfour was yesterday, this morning, an hour ago. We can't go back and say, well, sorry about Oslo, didn't work, did it? We've got a roadmap now. And we can't put the roadmap back on track. We're always putting the Oslo train back on track. Now the roadmap has to be reinvigorated, because we have to have not a Palestinian state, but a viable Palestinian state. I love that word viable. It's a very Blairite word. I'll tell you, I know somebody who has listened to a conversation between Blair and Bush about the issue of Palestine. This is, I promise you this is true. And Blair keeps saying to Bush, you know, we've got to deal with the Palestine question, the Palestinian-Israeli question, is central to the Middle East. And Bush keeps saying, yeah, I hear you, Tony, I hear you. Whether the British Prime Minister got what that meant, I don't know. But I hear you. It's okay, I hear you. You know, our reporting of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, in one way, helps to create the continuance of that conflict. Because if you look at your newspapers or you watch television, even the BBC is getting into this, BBC World Service Television, you'll find that mysteriously that huge wall that runs through Abu Dis and around Jerusalem is not a wall, it's a fence, or it's a barrier, or it's a security barrier, in the same way that the occupied area of South Lebanon from 1978 to 2000 was a security zone, not an occupied area. In the same way, the occupied territory of the West Bank has a deus ex machina turned into the disputed territory. A sort of dispute you can solve in a law court over a cup of tea, right? And colonies became settlements, I'm not quite sure when, and now very often become, quote, Jewish neighbourhoods. A neighbourhood, nice friendly place, like a neighbourhood here in, like, Berkeley. And thus, you see, even a Palestinian who throws one stone is incomprehensible. Why would anyone use violence when you've got a small dispute over a piece of territory? When you've got a fence that people don't like? When you've got a neighbourhood, nice friendly place like a neighbourhood? Thus, you see, we make our reporting of the Middle East incomprehensible to anyone in this country who doesn't know the region or hasn't been there. And thus, we make the Palestinians generically violent. Why on earth would they use violence in this kind of environment, you see? Now, I'm against violence by anyone, ever, for any reason. But the fact of the matter is that our reporting now makes inexplicable anything violent which the Palestinians do, and explicable anything the Israelis do which is violent, because they're always retaliating against terror. Thus, our journalism, you see, is lethal, but it isn't the only kind of lethality that we as journalists are involved in. Go back now to 1991 and the north road north of Kuwait up to Basra. I was on that road. And with an independent television crew, I came across a terrible scene. Across the desert lay dozens of dismembered bodies, bombs had hit in the desert there. Women and children as well, refugees fleeing from Iraq to Kuwait, Kuwait to Iraq, as well as many soldiers. And out of the desert came packs of dogs. It was lunchtime, they were hungry. And as we stood there, they ripped apart the bodies of men, women and children and took off arms and legs to eat in the desert. They were hungry. ITV filmed this. And I said to the crew, what on earth are you doing this for? You'll never get this on television. They'll not let it through. He said, ah, Bob, it's just for the archives. Now, that night, I could write exactly what I saw with all the detail of a medical report in my paper, The Independent, which I did. But, of course, it did not get on television because television editors in New York, London, Paris, wherever, are so sensitive about what their viewers might feel. It's pornographic to do this. It's obscene. It doesn't do justice to the dead who should be honoured. And anyway, who wants to watch this when they're having breakfast or lunch or tea or dinner? And so the reality of the war, which we see, is taken from you. You don't have to look at it. And in this way, we connive with governments that want you to support wars. We present you with a bloodless sandpit, unless, of course, an Iraqi has been obliging enough to die in a romantic attitude beside the road. The odd thing is that you can see what war is like if you go to the cinema. Saving Private Ryan does show the kind of foul, bloody wounds that we see with our own eyes when we're there. But it's only in an imaginative way for you. The reality, you will not be shown. And so the Bushes and the Blairs and the television directors and the editors in London and New York presenting you with this bloodless sandpit can allow you to think, well, war isn't that bad. I mean, I didn't see anything really terrible on television from Basra or Kuwait or Baghdad or wherever. I think this is one of the most dangerous parts of television reporting at the moment, that we constantly, constantly show a vision of war which is a lie. It is dirty, it smells, it is vile. I say over and over again, and my editor in London, Simon Kellner, always grits his teeth when I say the same thing, war is primarily not about victory and defeat, as Hollywood would suggest. War is primarily about death and the infliction of death and represents the total failure of the human spirit, whoever starts it. I wish I could finish by saying something optimistic. I don't see much optimism around. Iraq is chaos, from Mosul and Kirkuk all the way down to Basra. Drive Highway 8 with me and you'll see what I saw. Burned out American vehicles, smashed police vehicles, abandoned checkpoints, armed insurgents for 80 miles all the way to Najaf. It's over in Iraq. The project is finished. There is no future for democracy, referenda, constitutions. This is something we play out in our living rooms in Washington and London, or in the green zone in Baghdad. The real world of the Iraqis is almost too terrible to imagine. I met three of the insurgency leaders less than a year ago in a neighboring country, not Syria, it was Jordan. And the first man who walked in, who was a general in the Iraqi army, said, ah, Mr. Robert, we meet again. And I said, I haven't met you before. He said, ah, yes, you have, he said. You were under fire on the Iraqi front line outside Basra in 1980 when we invaded Iran. And I was the colonel who brought the first tanks, Iraqi tanks, across the Karun River. And you climbed on my tank and interviewed me. When I got back to Beirut, I don't use internet or computers. I put up all my paper files. And there he was. I did interview him in September of 1980. So that you see, the insurgency leaders are the commanders of the 1980-88 Iran-Iraq war. These are the men who fought for 8 years in suicidal battles against a massively superior force, the Iranians, and held the line. These are the men who, in many cases, tens of thousands of them went off to prison camps for 10 years in Iran, twice as long as any POW of the Second World War, and then came back to find their families being torn to pieces by sanctions. This is the insurgents, who were once called, you may remember, remnants and dead-enders. Do you remember that? Die-hards, Bremer used to call them. We don't call them that now. And an odd thing happened, again, because we didn't learn about the people of Iraq. I don't think we care about Iraqis. I don't think we care about Arabs very much. We thought that if we captured Saddam, the insurgency would end. Ladies and gentlemen, we got him. Remember Bremer's famous press conference? But 3 months before that, in Ramadi, which is a city further west from Fallujah, I was talking to a young man whose parents had just been shot at an American checkpoint. They got too close to it. 50 meters, we will use deadly force, it says on the road signs and on the back of all American vehicles in Iraq. And he said, you know, he said, last night the resistance came to my home, he told me, and asked me to join the Muqawama. And I said, did you join? He said, no, he said, I didn't, because you see, if we drive the Americans out, Saddam might come back. But if the Americans capture or kill Saddam, then I'll join the resistance. Yes. And indeed, after Saddam was captured, the insurgency took off like a firestorm. How wrong we got it, you see. Heaven knows what happens if we capture Osama bin Laden. One thing about that, by the way, it doesn't matter if he's dead or alive. He has created Al-Qaeda, the monster is born. It's like the nuclear bomb. Once you have nuclear weapons, you can arrest all the nuclear scientists in the world. Makes no difference, the bomb is there. Al-Qaeda, as an institution, now exists. We can capture or kill bin Laden. I think it makes no difference. He's irrelevant now. But thus, perhaps, you grasp the sense of pessimism I have about the Middle East at the moment. I hope, perhaps, Lebanon provides a nice little story. Lebanese people do feel freer. In restaurants now in Beirut, when I'm talking politics, I don't look over my shoulder like that. I just glance a little bit to each side, not so much. Maybe Lebanon can be a bright, shining light. But for the rest of the Middle East, I fear greatly. I think I should still write at the end of my reports, watch out. As I said before, I used to think that watching the history of the Middle East was a great privilege. Nowadays, 30 years later, when I can see people in San Francisco or Paris, families with children are happy, I think, what did I miss out on in life? Maybe this privilege of mine was a curse. And if it was, then my book is the story of my curse. Thank you very much.
That was a standing ovation for Robert Fisk, author and Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. His new book, The Great War for Civilization, is a compilation of 30 years of reporting in the context of a vivid and scholarly narration of history. I recorded him at a benefit for the Middle East Children's Alliance in Berkeley, California, in November 2005. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order an audio recording or a film on DVD of this talk by Robert Fisk. You can find more information on Robert Fisk on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape, CD, or DVD order is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE. For information on how to order, you can get your film or CD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call. ¶¶